Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa. This is my second conversation with Callum McCracken. We continue exploring the place of religion and public policy in the civil rights movement. Callum's undergraduate studies focused on political philosophy. He's now off to graduate school and will be working on issues of human rights on the international stage. My conversation began with Callum during his undergraduate studies. We talked about his interests in the political life of a number of countries, on international relations and issues of human rights as both a civil gift and a challenge for some cultural communities. We've also talked about the difficult issues often found in the public square and how we might deepen public understanding across the usual political silos. In this, our second conversation, Callum walks into the legacy of the Jim Crow laws and how the legislatures in the American South pushed back against Reconstruction. He explores the three pivotal pieces of legislation under President Lyndon Johnson: the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and the Fair Housing Act of 1968. Callum brings this story into what is unfolding in the United States currently, the work of various state legislatures to deprive many, particularly Black Americans, of the franchise, and the ongoing work of making a more perfect union. Welcome to our conversation. So, Callum, we came up to the Jim Crow period in our last conversation. So, what's the legacy of that? Can you lay that out for us?
Yeah. So, at last conversation we had, we kind of spoke briefly about the segregation dynamic of Jim Crow, wherein public facilities were segregated into Black and white, separate but equal, in Plessy versus Ferguson and other laws iterated in the state. But I think it's useful to go back and talk about Jim Crow's legacy on a more applied level and pragmatic one. In that way, I mean how it limited the franchise for Black voters, particularly in the South. Whether it be literacy tests, poll taxes, other segregation laws, or I was just looking into the grandfather clause, which is this arbitrary procedure in which you had to basically, you are allowed to forego the other preclearance procedures if you were to prove that your grandfather voted in the last election.
So these were all state. These were state
mandated
procedures, mm-hmm. in an effort to limit mm-hmm. the voting, largely of the Black community.
Yes, really curtail the franchise mm-hmm. of the African American community in the South, particularly Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. So there were several of them. Mm-hmm. What's the literacy one?
Literacy test is basically giving African Americans who, by that point, through the legacy of Jim Crow, had an institutional racism, had not received a proficient education to that point, and gave them tests that were designed to be designed to trip them up, designed to be hard for the community. They would sometimes point to a random point in the Constitution of the United States and ask them what it meant, or for them to recite it, or from memory, or essentially ask. It's like essentially a civics test in which, if they had no education or background, how would they know it? Mm-hmm. And that was very intentional.
It's extraordinary. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
Extraordinary. And then you mentioned this grandfather clause. So that's curious when you're talking about people who, in some cases, people whose grandparents would have been slaves.
Right. Like, if you're in the 60s, you know, I worked at a hospital in Chicago in the 60s when I was going to school. And I remember one of the first afternoons, I was on the afternoon shift. And for the evening shift at 9 o'clock at night or something like that, 10 o'clock at night, John Crook came in. And John Crook was an elderly black man. Nobody knew his age. He was very humorous, lovely man. And he told me that he liked to work the night shift because on the boilers, he was a stationary engineer, the boilers that heated the hospital, there were very loud bells. So he could sleep. And then if something went wrong, the bells would come on and they would wake him up no matter what. I got to know him and treasure him. And I realized I was talking to a man who was born to a couple 3 years after the end of slavery.
Oh my God.
He was born in 1868 or 69,
mm-hmm.
1870, something like that. He was well into his 90s at the time, and this was in the early 60s. So it was extraordinary to know a man whose parents had been there. So this grandfather clause, how did that work?
Well, yeah.
I mean, it sounds like an insult.
Exactly. And that's really, it's the legacy of that sort of those times during slavery prior to the Civil War, where slavery was more explicit, where these generations were lost in time. I mean, there were plenty of generations that weren't given names. They were split up. Their families were bifurcated in multiple ways. This grandfather clause was intentionally designed to limit the franchise because of the cultural genocide that took place.
You wouldn't even know your grandfather.
Exactly.
And there wouldn't be any record.
No, absolutely not. Or there might be a record with the, say, transatlantic
slave trade.
Yeah.
What's so striking about these things is that they are not only are they endeavoring to limit the exercise of the franchise, they are in and of themselves acts calculated to humiliate.
Absolutely. Yeah, Jim Crow is known as slavery by another name.
Yeah.
All taken together, it basically puts African Americans in an inherently subservient position. If they can't vote, they can't change their circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And those circumstances were derelict.
Mm-hmm. So then we come up to, to the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And to the unfolding of this movement.
Right.
How were they endeavoring to address it?
Right. So we discussed the student sit-in movement, the freedom rides. These were very, very much addressed at segregation laws. So public facilities being bifurcated into black and white, separate but equal. Very much, or businesses not serving African-American patrons, what have you. What I'd like to talk about today in more detail is sort of what we know as the Summer Project in 64, where in Mississippi, the voter registration, white to black, was 10 to 1. So there were
10 whites to 1 black.
One black.
That's the registration
process. Voter registration process. So,
and if you didn't register, you couldn't vote.
You couldn't vote. Exactly. And so there was a, particularly in Mississippi and many other southern states, there was a concerted effort to limit, as we were saying, limit the franchise. So there was this effort by people like Bob Moses, Fannie Lou Hamer, and other civil rights compatriots to go to Mississippi and register swaths of people to vote. So we had the Southern Christian Leadership Conference also help in this, which was led by Martin Luther King, of course, but they would gather in churches and community halls and basically run mock elections and educate the heretofore uneducated black population on trying to attain the franchise. They would do this, they would face a lot of violence from the population. So in response, the Summer Project of 64 invited students from Yale and Stanford, mostly, to come down in droves, northern students, to help in this effort. The Birmingham demonstrations and the televised nature of those had turned the tide nationally on what happened in the South, particularly with their violent reprisals being faced by these demonstrators. So there was a lot of a groundswell of support in the North to help with these endeavors. And so the summer project was an effort to bring all these kids from the South to help register the black population to vote.
There were enormous number of, a substantial number of students, but others as well, and many, many religious leaders. I mean, that was one of the things that King was so good at.
Mm-hmm.
He had the Southern Christian Leadership Organization, but he reached into many, many churches and synagogues.
Mm-hmm.
So I recall a lot of students doing this, and it was dangerous.
Oh yeah,
there were some that were killed in this process.
Yes, specifically there was two white students and one black student that were killed very famously in Mississippi, or they went missing in the Delta, and for basically months the police said that they had fled. Although we know now they knew where the bodies were the entire time because it was the police that killed them.
Yeah.
It was even J. Edgar Hoover was saying that they were seen in Brazil or something like that. They, even though he had no information about that, he was basically attempting to put a wet blanket on what would be an international crisis, what would come to be an international crisis.
So they finally get some of them registered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we come to, particularly what we talked about with these two white students dying and one black individual. Unfortunately, because of the composition of the race, it brought international outrage and attention to the issue. These two northern educated, clean-cut students were basically brought out to the Delta and shot.
Mm-hmm.
And that brought so much national attention that there were concessions made by state governments too. And particularly Lyndon Johnson's government that finally passed in 64 the Civil Rights Act. Now, the Civil Rights Act is in response to mostly to segregation. It gives the Attorney General the right to sue these states if they contravene these laws. So it was basically the federal government finally, after the black activists have been hitting their heads against the wall, finally they see some federal recognition of their plight.
And the federal government can't do a lot. So it's beginning to do something. Because in the United States, it's striking. States' rights are very strong. And states control all the election process and apparatus. So the federal government, using the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and extending, as Martin Luther King made so clear, we just want in.
Mm-hmm.
We want America to be its best. So we need to be able to vote.
Right. And that's what comes with the... And unfortunately, the Civil Rights Act doesn't address that completely. So that's what comes in 65, which is the Voting Rights Act. And the Voting Rights Act, particularly...
This is a year later.
This is a year later. Yeah, because they kept... After the Civil Rights Act, they actually kept on protesting, kept on bugging the federal government. Lyndon Johnson didn't want to keep legislating on this issue. In fact, he wanted to strike a sort of conciliatory tone to Southern Democrats, Dixiecrats, as he called them, and to these civil rights Northerners and civil rights activists. He didn't want there to be a large, what he would maybe even consider something akin to a second civil war based on these racial fault lines. So he was very much dragging his feet, but they kept at it. They kept bringing attention to the issue, particularly by the Democratic Freedom Conference that they launched in Mississippi. They launched a Democratic Party. These black activists launched a Democratic Party themselves, and they tried to bring about attention to the issue that these Southern Dixiecrats weren't following any of the electoral procedures properly. They were circumventing the rights of black people to attain political office. And when that was brought to light, it brought an even louder call to basically provide and instill these voting and voting rights into stone. And that's when we get the Civil Rights Act, I'm sorry, the Voting Rights Act of 65. And particularly the Section 2 saying of no voting qualification or standard or procedure or practice may be imposed by these states that fall on the account of race or color.
So this is making use of the long-standing American legal notion that everybody should have the right to vote, but it is addressing the particular way in which this is being prevented.
Right.
So that act essentially outlaws states from imposing these impediments.
Exactly.
To voting.
Mm-hmm. We have Section 15 of the Constitution allows everyone to vote. However, the states through Jim Crow contravened the Section 15 of the vote of the Constitution. If after the VRA in the 1960s, the white to black voter registration was 3-1.
So from 10-1 to 3-1.
Well, this is still in the 1960s. In Mississippi, it was still 10-1 in the 60s. But after the VRA, those variations largely disappeared. In 1960s, there was a very large disparity of voter registration. But by the 1980s, this shows you the power of the VRA, Voter Rights Act. There, these huge variations, particularly in Mississippi and in the South, 3-1, had largely dissipated, largely. So this shows you that the power of this movement, the power of the legislation, is can't be overstated. It can't be overstated. It had a massive impact.
I'm struck in thinking about it, casting my mind back to those days. I'm struck again by just how significant King and many of the other black pastors have been. You know, we've had this problem within Christian churches, or this divide in Christian churches, Callum, whereby the liberal wing of Christian churches has often talked about justice. Mm-hmm. And the need for justice. And the evangelical wing and the conservative wing of the Christian churches, and this crosses denominations, speaks about charity and about how governments are overreaching around everything. And we really need to just do things ourselves. We touched on this a little bit with, just a little bit, but in, of course, in a very different way with Dorothy Day, you know, and Dorothy Day's notion that we have to be participating with the poor in solidarity with them, doing things. But on a larger level within Christian churches, it's extraordinary, and this goes back quite a long way, that you have a part of the church that is concerned with justice, a part of the church that's concerned with charity, and I think one of the things that happened here, at least in many cases, is that people like Dr. King and other people in the Baptist churches and other churches, they begin to break up that old siloed view of things. I mean, this is, the Voting Rights Act is such a dramatic example of it. If you can't vote, if you are prevented as a community, then of course, not only are you not able to exercise the franchise, you're not able to exercise leadership.
Yeah, true. Yeah, they, at Martin Luther King, like we were talking about last time, reached into that prophetic tradition where he wasn't satisfied with the incremental change of society. That he conceived his Christian faith as a call to action to basically move it forward.
It's amazing also to me how politicians find themselves in a position, which in the first place is surprising. Lyndon Johnson, you know, wasn't necessarily going to be president.
No.
That came about in a tragic way. He is from the South. He's from Texas. And yet history dealt him a hand. And even though you said he obfuscated, he tried to dance around it, but then he decided to spend his capital on it.
True.
It's remarkable, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, he was known to be a very shrewd politician.
Yeah.
Very much so. And
excellent at policy.
Excellent.
And figuring out how to shape policy.
Mm-hmm. And that's why he came up with these policies that are still animating today. There's a very famous photo where he, particularly when he's in the Oval Office, where he's talking to you know, people who he wants to basically pressure to pass a bill or something like that. He used to have this old technique where he'd lean right over them. Absolutely no space given to them.
He was a big man.
He was a towering man. He'd tower over them. And there's plenty of pictures you can see of him with different politicians around the White House, in his Oval Office, where he's just his posture is imposing, and he's just towering over them.
And he talked like a Texan.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And that's another factor. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a plain talking man.
Truly. Yeah, and what he did was not the easy decision, even though he did drag his feet in certain ways, which I suppose is, if we were to view it in the time that happened, was a very understandable move. But he went ahead, and would manage to secure enough of the vote to make these things federal law.
So the franchise, the Voting Rights Act, which pushed back against the state's attempts to circumvent them.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a third one, wasn't there?
Right. So we get back, we go to, that brings us to around 68. And just prior to that was the assassination of Martin Luther King. So the assassination of Martin Luther King, prior to this, he was very much concerned, as we were talking about with the last podcast, near the end of his life, with economic justice regarding labor laws and particularly fair housing. to that point, it was in the North, they called it secret Jim Crow, where basically there was a practice of communities excluding the black population from accessing mortgages or financial help for them to access housing. There was neighborhoods that were basically fault lines, racial fault lines, because the white neighborhoods would either flee should a black family move in, or they just simply weren't allowed. Mm-hmm. Because if black families move in, it would depreciate, in their minds, depreciate the value of their communities and homes, which is horrible. So following the assassination of Martin Luther King, again, it inspired the federal government to act to pass the Fair Housing Act, which basically guaranteed economic equality in this vein. However, in practice, this kind of institutional equality still sort of persists. Black home ownership stands at around 40% to this day, compared to around 73% for whites. Mm-hmm. There's still a very much persistent racial wealth gap that exists.
It's very hard to get a leg up in the American economy or in Canada, because they both work the same way, if you don't have some kind of family resources, if there isn't some kind of wealth that's developed and that the children can build upon.
Right.
It's very difficult. And a major way of the families beginning to have a bit of capital is, of course, through owning a home. And that requires getting a mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
And that requires going to a bank or a brokerage company of some sort or another. So those laws attempted to level the playing field. So if a black person came to a bank
mm-hmm.
to get a loan, they weren't just immediately dismissed.
Right.
There had to be some consideration of them.
Right. However, because of the legacy of these redlining policies and basically blocking of financial financing to homes and helping people out financially, get a leg up and get that capital with a house, we have the legacy of that is what we now know as ghettos. We have large poor neighborhoods that are basically the legacy of this economic inequality, in which generational poverty persists.
It is shifting, but I'll tell you, when I in 68, of course, when King was killed, there were relatively very, very few black people, even in the northern cities, that owned any property.
Mm-hmm.
The West Side Ghetto, where I lived for a period of time, was all owned by First National Bank of Chicago and Bard Warner, which was a huge real estate holding company. So the west side of Chicago was largely three flats, you know, brick buildings, cheek by jowl, three floors with multiple families in them, and they were all rented. And so this is another little wiggle to this. When Martin Luther King was murdered, those communities all went up in flames. I saw this occur. I saw the American military come down the Dan Ryan Expressway.
Mm.
Big flatbed trucks, tanks on it. And they circled the West Side Ghetto, which was on fire. They didn't go in. They just circled it with barbed wire, razor wire, and the military. The most apocalyptic thing I've ever seen in my life. to see the whole of that area in flames. And not only Chicago, and this is a big area. We're talking, I should know this, but I don't. I mean, we're talking, I don't know, 40 or 80 square blocks, maybe more than that. And it happened all over the United States. So all of a sudden, every American was faced with, every white American was faced with seeing in the heart of their own cities, ruin of a catastrophic level.
Yeah, well, the Detroit riots, which happened around this time as well. The
same thing.
Massive, what basically it inspired the Kerner Commission, which looked into the economic inequalities regarding this. And that commission came out with basically highlighted the hypocrisy of the North to basically think that they were somehow free from this racial inequality. The way that they structured them, these cities economically, had created such desperation that it would naturally lead to violence, crime, and what have you.
I think it's one of the things that led to a sea change in America. It's amazing how fire can purify.
Indeed.
And the profound nature of it, I think, had an effect on many Americans to realize that we just got to put this together differently.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a while back.
Yeah.
And one of the things that interests me about the work you've been doing is because you've been walking those pathways and you have a deep interest in policy, so you've seen how these policies came about and the kinds of shifts that they endeavor to make and do to some extent make. And we're now in 2023. And I'm really interested when you, because you pay some attention to the news and to what's going on. What's going on in the United States and other places. How does this speak to what's happening now in the United States? What do you see? What kind of concerns emerge for you?
Well, it's a very interesting question, because I think a lot of civil rights activists who are still alive today will tell you the same thing, that the work is incomplete. The legacy of the VRA, the Voting Rights Act in particular, has been slowly eroded away. In 2013, for instance, we had a decision, Shelby County v. Holder, which basically weakened the VRA significantly by annulling Section 4. So Section 4 was the proviso that basically these southern states, these particular southern states, like Mississippi, like we were talking about, had to check with the federal government before they made preclearance procedures that would inhibit someone's right to vote. So in 2013, they got rid of this. The states argued it to the Supreme Court level, and it was about a 5-4 decision.
And
split.
This was argued against the Attorney General Holder, who was black.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right. Exactly.
Barack Obama.
And this basically weakened the VRA to such a degree that now states, I see after these pre-clearance procedures were essentially nullified, so states, southern states in particular, didn't have to check in if there was going to be any arbitrary voter abridgments. Now that has been annulled. The legacy of that today that I see is pretty obvious. We've seen many states that are now doing bringing back preclearance procedures, voter ID laws. Even there is a huge one that disproportionately affects the poor and the black populations. Various other crafty same day voting. There's a manifold of different processes that are being implemented in these mostly Republican states to try and limit the franchise because their electorate is very much they're trying to appeal mostly to their electorate. The other massive
to their white electorate.
Their white electorate, yeah. Exactly. The other thing that I've noticed is just prior to the Voting Rights Act, the next thing that the Democrats did, it's almost like a protean monster because it evolved. So although they can't specifically let people inhibit people from voting, after that they started splitting up the communities. So they would what they call gerrymander, which is basically splitting up voting blocks and dividing them up. So what would normally make a county that would vote for some that would vote somebody into office or have given
usually somebody from the county.
Exactly.
People knew.
Mm-hmm. They would, if there was a majority black area, they divide it into four, for example, basically diluting the voting power of that given community.
So that community then, a portion of it would be voting with a much larger white community.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's called congressional redistricting.
Yeah.
And it's a very crafty way of diluting the black vote. Not to say that the left doesn't do congressional redistricting too.
Of course.
It's a very common practice, but it has become such that it has limited the franchise.
So we're still in the throes of this. It moves back and forth.
Indeed.
Has it caused you to ponder? Perhaps you always have done this, I don't know. But has it caused you to ponder this matter of racism? And just how deep and insipid it can be? And what that means for a society?
Yes. Looking at my work is... You establish a bit of a historical through line all the way back from the transatlantic slave trade, what would be considered the original sin of the United States, all the way up to now. I think that there is we're still reconciling these racial relations and these inequalities that have manifested themselves historically. The idea, it's an idea of American exceptionalism versus reckoning with our own history. That seems to be the tension that I see on the left and right.
Mm-hmm.
There's laws being put on the books by, say, someone like Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, who's his latest invective is essentially trying to get rid of what we call critical race theory in Florida schools to some success. It's Black History Month this month.
Mm-hmm.
And Black History Month endeavors to try and remind people of the history behind these things because, as we discussed, this history reverberates into now.
Mm-hmm.
And someone like Ron DeSantis, by taking away something so essential to teaching this history, i.e. critical race theory in schools, trying to basically make it an arbitrary concept, a historical concept, I think has a really bad, deleterious effects for our future.
When Barack Obama was running for the American presidency, I invited Molly Worthen, who's a young professor in the States, up here to give a couple lectures at the Ronning Center. One of them she called, she titled the lecture, Jesus for President. And it was really looking at the evangelical world and how it understands these things. So she was up here right at the time of the election, and she did a lecture in Camrose and a lecture here in Edmonton. And then that evening of the American election, we came. I invited a few people over, and she was here. And we watched as the results came in, and Barack Obama was elected to the presidency of the United States. John Crook, that man who tended the boilers at Swedish Covenant Hospital in Chicago that I met, He was so present to me, as was Rudy Smith, who was on the maintenance team that I worked with at the hospital, who was a gold glove boxing champion as well, who I knew well. He was a bit older than me, but, you know, I was young. Rudy might have been 30. I was in my early 20s. And Rudy had grown up in the South as well. There was... I wept, actually. I was surprised at my own reaction. But it's there because, having been in Chicago for 10 years, you know, racism is just palpable. Mm-hmm. And it is evil. I mean, you see its evilness. And I shed tears and remembered these two men who touched my life when I was a young student. And I think for the first time in my life, I said, God bless America. God bless America. As awful as it is, seeing these turns, and of course, we now see, we've seen over the last few years, the attempt to push back against what is perceived as what Obama brought to the table. The other thing that is really striking to me is the degree to which the Black community in America has managed to get into positions of significance in many, many areas. For a long time, it was only sport, but it no longer is. It's the arts, it's finances, It's the communication media. So in a way, it's a very different world from what it was, with still an enormous amount to do. But it's being done now.
Right.
It's being done now from within the Black community as well, and within the public square, because many have risen to the top, and the voices are loud and clear.
Absolutely.
So it's, I was surprised that evening when the words God bless America crossed my lips.
Some patriotism.
Well, I'm not an American, I'm glad I'm a Canadian.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the 60s, we would turn that phrase around a fair bit because we were so concerned with the issues of race, the issues of the Vietnam War, the issues of poverty and what have you.
You're like, God bless America.
And God blast America, was normally said. So it is a remarkable country. And of course, original sins never really disappear. But they can be lived out in very different ways. And some of that's happening. And it's extraordinary to see and extraordinary to know some of those leaders that had such courage and such prophetic voices to bring about the change and to continue to do it. So
truly, that's the important part.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to talk about it.
Thank you for joining us. When I lived in Chicago in the 1960s, I saw the shadow of racism. It was palpable, lethal, and for me, a young man, the closest I'd ever come to witnessing evil. The dangers of studying only our social diseases are that it may lead us to cynicism or, at worst, despair. In our work together on the civil rights movement, Callum has deepened his knowledge of Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders. He has seen their clear-sightedness, determination, and willingness to endure. He has met many thinkers and activists who established the ground on which to stand and ways of working towards what is life-giving. Reinhold Niebuhr, Dorothy Day, and others. I've been touched by his work on the prophetic tradition that informed the life and work of these 20th century saints. This has now become, or so it seems to me, part of the tradition he may carry forward as his work and thinking unfold. Please join me in the third of our conversations with Callum. We turn to the rise of Christian nationalism in liberal democratic countries. I welcome your comments on the various themes in this podcast and invite you to visit our website. Contact details may be found in the program notes.